Woman aimed at Jennifer as she ran away, Harry said. And she had a homemade garrote in her purse. Like the one used to kill Tommy Payne near Penn Station? I've already called Ed Arris. We think it's the murder weapon. Harry, this shit has gone from doing a favor for the mayor to a full-blown conspiracy. We have to do something. We have to find Natalie London. She's in real danger. Harry put his hand on my shoulder. You need to get some rest. That's all you need to worry about right now. Spend a little time with that beautiful family. Someone will call you as soon as there's news on Jennifer Chang. Reluctantly, I agreed with my friend. I waited until Harry left. Then I waited a while longer. I checked with the nurse one more time. I had to fight the feeling that Harry had lost faith in me. I felt like I'd let people down, especially Jennifer Chang. I wondered if anyone would even keep me up to date on the shooting. Technically, I wasn't suspended, but cops rarely like to be seen talking to a detective sent home for any reason. I was sure rumors about me would spread quickly. They'd revolve around some imagined confrontation I had with management. No one would believe that my friend of almost 20 years had suggested I go home and see my family. Instead, I would go home after I was sure Jennifer Chang was out of danger. Chapter 48. I walked through the front door of my apartment completely drained. It's easy to imagine that a homicide detective always feels drained when arriving home. That's not accurate. I usually get a bolt of energy anticipating seeing my kids and Mary Catherine. I love coming home to my family. Tonight it was different. I had absolutely no energy and I couldn't focus. I wondered if the cumulative effect of the shootings had finally caught up to me. I had lingered at the hospital until I found out Jennifer Chang had made it through surgery and was in recovery. A young surgeon named Susan Jones had come out to talk to me, even though she knew I wasn't family and wasn't the detective on the case involving Jennifer. She was in her scrubs with more than a few blood smears and other stains. Her hair poking out from under her surgical cap was limp with sweat, and wide perspiration stains had seeped from under her arms. No one could ever tell me that surgeons weren't athletes on some level. To stand and concentrate for so many hours without a break takes real determination and stamina. Dr. Jones motioned me to sit down on a couch. I think it was more about her getting off her feet than delivering bad news to me. She said, "I'm very impressed you waited here for her. I heard you tried to shield her from the gunfire. That's brave, even for a cop. Is Jennifer going to recover?" "She lost a lot of blood. The bullet entered about 4 inches from her spine, but worked its way through her torso. Her stomach was perforated, and her left lung collapsed. She'll be in the ICU for days, maybe weeks." I sagged in my seat. The doctor touched my arm and said, "You've done all you can. There won't be an update for some time. Please go home and get some rest. I don't even know you, and I have to say, you look terrible. Please forgive me." She gave me a weak smile and then was gone. I'm not even sure how I made it back to the apartment. I was on automatic pilot. Now I stood in the doorway and still couldn't shake all of my fears about Natalie London. Whoever she was involved with meant business. I believed she was in Estonia. In fact, I knew it. But I had no idea if she was there by consent or if she'd been forced to go. This was troubling on a number of levels. Having my oldest daughter, Juliana, greet me at the door only emphasized my fears. How would I feel if Juliana disappeared like Natalie? I'd be calling in all the favors I could. I was starting to understand the mayor a little better. I made my rounds in the apartment, greeting each kid individually. I could tell that Mary Catherine was still worried about me. Sometimes I wondered if she and Harry Grissom secretly traded phone calls about my mental state and general health. Eventually, I found myself next to the computer with Eddie. After I caught up on his daily life, school, and basketball, I got to the point. "Eddie, I'm having a little trouble comprehending some kids who are drawn to working with a certain hacker in Estonia. I know the money is pretty good, but is there something else?" Eddie's face positively lit up. "Dad, you have no idea. It's the closest a kid like me will come to having a superpower. Just because I understand computers and most people really don't. Once I found out I understood what hackers were talking about, it was easy. I follow a couple of forums online and read some blogs by hackers. It doesn't surprise me the hacker is based in Estonia. Why's that? Estonia is considered the most wired republic in Europe. The government views access to the internet as a human right. They spent a fortune on infrastructure to attract high-tech companies. Most kids your age don't even know where Estonia is. I'm very impressed. We studied it in history class, how after World War II, the Soviet Union essentially took control of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. That makes their rise as a computer power all the more impressive. I sat for a moment thinking about Holy Name. I knew it was a good school. I've sent all my kids there. But I didn't remember learning anything like that when I was in school. Of course, my interest in history didn't come on until I was in college. Then Eddie explained to me the draw of young people to crack security systems at different companies or government facilities. It was the cyberpunk's version of climbing Mount Everest. Basically, they did it because it was there. I settled back in my chair and said, Eddie, would you mind showing me some of the forums and blogs that you read? By the smile on my son's face, you would have thought I'd given him a jet ski. He loved this kind of stuff. Chapter 49. At 8 o'clock, we all gathered around the speakerphone on the breakfast nook counter. I'd bought the phone at Best Buy specifically for these nights. Sure, it was a little crowded with 12 people trying to get close enough to both hear the speaker and be heard when they spoke. This was our weekly call from Brian. It was the one night no one ever argued about what we were going to do. No one wanted to miss even a moment of talking to their brother. Mary Catherine and my grandfather Seamus always sat in two straight-back chairs closest to the phone. At 1 minute after 8, the phone rang, and Seamus hit the button within a second. He looked like a gambler in Las Vegas asking for another card. We settled down to a near silence. After Brian said hello and told us how everything was going, everyone got to say hello and one other thing. It took about 10 minutes to work through the whole family. I was touched to see how excited the kids were to talk to their brother. It meant I'd done something right raising them. 10 kids in a family was difficult enough. If some of them didn't get along, it could be brutal. I found it was easy enough to keep everyone happy if they were busy. Sports, clubs, family play dates, it all added up. And right now, I appreciated that arithmetic. Trent told Brian about basketball and sports. Chrissy told him about our cat, Saki, who is now producing solid poop after a week of diarrhea. I never tried to edit what my kids were going to say. Finally, I got to ask some questions that were important to me. How do you like Fishkill Correctional? Compared to Gowanda, it's great. I'm taking a bunch of classes. I already told you I earned my GED. Now I'm working on getting certified as an air conditioning repair mechanic. They have the population separated by security risk, so I'm in with a bunch of younger, nonviolent offenders. I thought I might cry. Here was my oldest son, along with his sister Juliana, my first treasure. A year ago, I was afraid he'd thrown away his whole life because he made some poor choices. Now he was making good choices. More important, he hadn't given up on his life. He just made a detour or two. He had some goals, and I was so proud of him I couldn't speak for a moment. Luckily, plenty of other people were there to fill in. Seamus said, Hey, what are you doing for fun? This place gives us full TV privileges at night. As long as we follow the rules and don't have any marks against us, we can watch whatever we want. I've been reading a lot, too. Jane, our resident super reader, was quick to ask, Who do you like to read? Brian didn't hesitate. Elmore Leonard and a newer author named Mark Greene. Can't get enough of either of them. Now I was at a loss for words. I'd never known Brian to read for pleasure, and he sounded excited about his studies. Brian said, This place is so much better than Gowanda, I can't believe it. But I still miss home. I miss all of you. If I get home, I promise to keep reading and I'll get a job. I swear. I was quick to say, Buddy, you don't have to make any promises. We want you home as much as you want to come home. Eddie said, I'm trying to teach Dad about computers and hacking. Brian laughed like we were playing a prank on him. Then he said, Really? I'm impressed, Dad. You won't be sorry you picked up a new skill. We even have computers available to us here. One guy from Schenectady got arrested again for stealing credit card numbers using the computer from our class. Mary Catherine took a moment to tell Brian all the meals she would cook for him as soon as he got home. The call ended after our allotted 20 minutes and we had been forced into quick goodbyes. If anything, it made me consider the mayor's offer of help more seriously. Chapter 50. Detectives at the NYPD have an unusual relationship with one of their own units, known as Intel. The Intelligence Bureau has a mysterious aura about it. Generally, the unit recruits the best and brightest from all the NYPD divisions to provide command staff with intelligence about growing crime trends and potential catastrophes. Since the 9/11 terror attacks, the unit has grown and wields more influence. One thing most people don't realize about it is that it has offices outside New York, too. In fact, the NYPD has offices outside the U.S. Some of those offices are in Europe and the Middle East. It's hard to imagine an NYPD officer roaming the streets of Madrid, but in the new millennium, that's a reality. I learned a long time ago that Intel is an incredible resource for a detective. The staff are smart and helpful and don't care about claiming credit for a case. That cuts down on turf wars. I'd given all I had on Natalie London and the cases surrounding her to my friend in Intel, Lieutenant Tony Martindale. I gave up telling him what to do with information years ago. He'd talked to sources and other agencies, especially with connections overseas, and somehow he always worked magic with everything I gave him. Once, when I had nothing on a homicide except a partial fingerprint, Lieutenant Martindale had a source in the Guatemalan military who matched the print to one of their former soldiers. As a result, I made the arrest and also helped narcotics bust up one of the bigger drug-running groups in the city. The former sergeant in the Guatemalan army confessed to the homicide and would be in Sing Sing until the middle of the century. Yet the only ones who claimed any credit were narcotics detectives. Tony Martindale never opened his mouth once, even though he was the one who had cracked the case for everyone. That's why I trusted him with everything I knew or suspected about the hacking ring run by the mysterious Henry in Estonia. The day after the Brew shootout, I was in the lieutenant's private office in a corner of the intel unit. The office suited him. There were journals on combating terrorism, the newest firearms, police tactics, public administration, and even one on photography. This guy was like a computer. He read everything and didn't care one way or the other if people utilized him. I sat in an uncomfortable metal chair as the lieutenant rolled around behind his desk on his ancient Office Depot discount chair. He was giving someone crime statistics over the phone while checking his email and answering a text, and this was a slow day for Lieutenant Tony Martindale. Finally, he hung up the phone, looked at me, and said, "I'm sorry, Mike, as you can imagine, it's crazy around here, but I have the information you asked about." I knew not to do anything except smile and nod. I didn't want to risk sending him off on another tangent that might take 5 or 10 minutes. He waited for a comment, then picked up a folder from a pile on his desk, like he knew exactly which one to reach for. He leaned back in the black chair and said, "You might have stumbled onto something big. This guy you asked about, Endrick Lahr, has about 10 aliases. He has 3 official IDs issued in Estonia and Latvia, but none of the 3 IDs has the same photo. None of the investigators I spoke with over the phone are even sure if they have an accurate description of him. What are they tracking him for?" "Cybercrime. The son of a bitch has a decent blackmail business going. The big corporations are terrified of hackers like him, and the young programmers flock to him. They know they can make a lot more money with him than they can at a legitimate job." I asked, "Anyone have any idea about U.S. nationals working for him? Specifically the name I gave you, Natalie London?" The lieutenant gave me a grin. "I assume you know who her father is?" I could neither confirm nor deny that I know the identity of Natalie London's father. Lieutenant Martindale let out a hearty laugh. "Spoken like an intel detective. If you ever get tired of chasing down murderers, we'll always have a place for you here." I didn't want to tell him that showing up at one police plaza every day would cause me too much stress. I'd probably end up with some rash or other disgusting reaction. The lieutenant said, I've done a favor or two for the LFP. How'd it work out? Just did my job. He seemed okay in a pudgy politician kind of way. He waited for me to either laugh or agree. Instead, I said, we can still keep this conversation between us, right? Intel is known for its discretion. Now here's a list of potential addresses and associates of Mr. Lahr. As he handed me the papers bound in a small folder, Lieutenant Martindale gave me a sideways glance. You're not thinking of going to Estonia, are you? Why? We don't have an office there. Would be difficult to give you much support. So I'd be on my own. I didn't say that. I just said it would be difficult to help you. The NYPD never leaves a man behind. We'd make sure you had what you needed. What about the Estonian police? Would they help if I needed it? Who knows? They deal with the U.S. Embassy and the FBI lead guy who covers all the Baltics. It'd take a while to get official approval for your trip through the FBI. Well, then let's forget our brothers and sisters who work for the federal government. Is that okay? Martindale laughed again. I rarely think of them here in New York. You're good to go as far as I'm concerned. I always appreciated my visits to the NYPD Intel Bureau. Chapter 51. It's surprisingly easy for an NYPD detective to get an audience with the mayor of New York when you have information about his daughter. Within 30 minutes of my call to his assistant, I was in Mayor Alfred Hanna's main office in City Hall. If I had ever questioned the mayor's concern for his daughter, I now realize it was genuine. Although overweight and out of shape, the mayor was always known for dressing well. The New York Post had even branded him the Dapper Dumbass. Today, image seemed to be the last thing on his mind. He looked like he hadn't slept in 3 days. The mayor already had a synopsis of the shootout at Brew. He knew it was related to his daughter. That only made him more anxious. We sat on a black leather couch. I noticed a photo collage on the wall, images of his daughter from toddlerhood to her graduation from high school. There were other collages of his sons, but this one struck a chord. I wouldn't look any better than him if one of my kids was missing. I didn't know how else to say it, so I got right to the point. Mayor, everything I've learned points to your daughter being in Tallinn, Estonia. I need to take a trip there to run down more leads. I'm afraid that if your daughter was there of her own free will, she would have been in touch with her mother. Just a phone call, something. That's why I need to travel. The news about his daughter bothered the mayor. For a moment, I thought he might cry. And then he looked up at me and said, I can't authorize travel like that. That kind of expense to find my daughter would cause the press to eviscerate me. There's already been enough coverage of my divorce. That's what drove the wedge between Natalie and me in the first place. From a public employee's perspective, I understood what he was saying. From a father's perspective, I was baffled. I would use everything in my power to find one of my kids. To hell with the media or anyone else. The mayor stared silently out the window for a few moments. Then he turned to face me again. The couch felt like a giant beanbag chair, forcing us to sit close to each other. The mayor said, I know what you're thinking, detective. You think all I care about is my political position. That's not correct. Now I heard the weariness in his voice. He was beyond exhausted and just wanted to find his daughter. The mayor continued, I'm in a catch-22. I can't authorize excessive city funds for a public employee to find my daughter, and I can't use my own money to pay a public employee. I want to find my daughter, but I've also sworn to uphold laws and stick to a code of ethics. You guys at the PD and the people at the fire department may hate my policies about pay raises, but I made them in the best interest of the city. And now I can't send you to find my daughter because it's not in the best interest of the city. In fact, it goes against every position I ran on. Favoritism, funneling resources to the wealthy areas, and corruption within the city government itself. As he talked, his voice got stronger and he almost sounded like he was on the stump. but I understood what he was saying. I was even a little surprised by what he was saying. He was trying to do the right thing, no matter how hard it was. I had to respect that. I also had to tell him what I intended to do. I said, "Mr. Mayor, I'm going to go look for Natalie on my own. No one needs to know. Not the media, not your constituents, not even your aides." Now the mayor stared at me. His mouth dropped open in surprise. All he could manage to say was, "Why?" "Because I'm a father, and I have daughters." Chapter 52. I braced for a brisk discussion, or what some people might call an argument, when I finally got Mary Catherine alone that night. I explained everything that happened and finished with, "Yeah, that's why I feel like I have to go to Estonia. That girl may be in real trouble, and no one's going to do anything about it." I almost felt like closing my eyes and shying away as I waited for a torrent of Irish anger. Sometimes she used insults I had to look up or ask my grandfather to translate to judge how angry she was. Mary Catherine was constantly concerned about me at work. She understood my sense of duty and the fact that I loved my job, and she maintained that she fell in love with me after I was already a cop. She understood it was part of me. That didn't mean she kept quiet about her concerns. This time she surprised me. As we stood on our balcony listening to the gentle sounds of the city, she leaned across and kissed me on the cheek. Then she slid in close and locked arms with me. She didn't say a word. After a full minute, I had to ask, "Do you have a problem with me traveling to Estonia?" "Will I miss you? Yes. Will I worry about you? Yes. Do I understand why you feel you have to go?" "Once again, I'd have to say yes. Michael, you're nothing if not predictable when it comes to doing the right thing." I gave Mary Catherine a sideways glance. "You're being remarkably reasonable about this. Am I walking into a trap?" "I know how precious your daughters are to you. I just worry for your safety. You can't fix everyone's problems." "No, but I might be able to fix this one." "Can you count on anyone for help over there? The FBI? Anyone?" This could have been an opportunity to ease her fears and tell her there was nothing to worry about. But that flew in the face of my policy of being open and honest with the woman I intended to spend the rest of my life with. "No, I'll just be a tourist," Mary Catherine said. "A tourist who might have to tangle with a gang." "A gang of computer geeks." Okay, so I was misleading her a little bit. My grandfather wandered out onto the balcony to join us. I had filled him in earlier on what I planned to do. Seamus said, "I've made a few calls. You'll have some help from the clergy if you should need it." "Great, I could use some tough, elderly backup. Maybe they can help me put these boys on the right track and convince them to forget about crime." Seamus didn't even bother with his usual scowl. Mary Catherine said, "I didn't realize the Roman Catholic community was so big in Estonia." Seamus said, "But it's growing all the time. But in this case, I spoke to one of my friends in the Orthodox Church. He understands your situation and is prepared to help. Marty Zlatich is the rector of St. Laszlo's in Tallinn." He handed me a sheet of paper with a confusing phone number. I stared at my grandfather and said, "You never fail to surprise me. I thought you only conned other Catholic priests." The old man smiled. "I have friends across all denominations. You need only ask, and I can find someone to help. We all talk." That seemed to satisfy some of Mary Catherine's concerns, at least for the moment. Chapter 53. As we stood near the TSA line in JFK, I wondered what the European tourist arriving thought of my horde of kids, fiancé, and grandfather all huddled around me. They probably viewed the scene and thought I must be on my way to a combat zone. Chrissy was crying. I was not sure why. Even Trent was a little clingy. He stood right next to me with his arm around my waist. Eddie handed me a sheet of paper. He said, "Just some computer terms that might keep you from looking stupid." I appreciated his faith in me. I glanced at the sheet, and the first term I saw was laptop. How tech illiterate did he think I was? Shauna motioned to me to lean down. She pulled me closer and whispered in my ear, "I love you, Dad. I'll think about you every minute you're away. It was the sweetest thing a little girl could say to her father. It choked me up for a moment while I said goodbye to everyone else. I gave each one an individual hug and kiss. Then I found I needed a giant hug with everyone crammed together. We must have looked like a rugby scrum. This whole weird case had crystallized for me just how much my family meant to me. It sounded sappy to say they were my whole world, but they really were. As we held a hug for a few seconds, I felt the missing Brian like a physical pain. It made me think about a verse from Matthew. I could just get it roughly right in my head. If a shepherd cares for 100 sheep and one wanders off, will he not leave the other 99 to look for that one? Now that verse made more sense than ever before. Mary Catherine sobbed as I gave everyone a last giant squeeze, and she slipped in as the others started to break the hug. She wrapped her arms around my neck and pulled me in for a long kiss. I could taste her salty tears running down her cheeks. I prayed I could slip away without bawling like a little kid myself. She broke the kiss and whispered in my ear, "I love you so much that I know you'll come back to me safe. If you love me the same way, make sure that happens." That was the best challenge I'd ever been given. Seamus was indispensable as he helped break up the crowd around me and held them for a moment as I backed away. A TSA agent who had witnessed our extended goodbye gave me a flat stare as I turned around. I thought I was about to get a touching comment about how beautiful my family was or some earnest words of encouragement. Instead, he cleared his throat and said, "Get in that line," pointing to a winding line of people at the far end of the security area. About 10 minutes after our goodbye, as I stood in line, waiting to take off my shoes and walk through a security scanner, I got a text. It was from Mary Catherine. All it said was, "I love you." Now I started to tear up. That was all the encouragement I needed. Chapter 54. After a reasonable layover in Frankfurt that gave me time for a quick bite, my Lufthansa flight to Tallinn went quickly, and we landed at the Lennart Meri Airport fairly late in the evening local time. I would have liked to see the place during the day for a better look at the giant panels on the roof. I wasn't sure if they were decorative or solar, but either way, they were impressive. It was a pleasant-looking, bustling terminal. Even at this hour, the place had decent traffic around the kiosk for Nordica, the national airline of Estonia. Almost as soon as I started heading through the main terminal, I noticed two men following me. One was about 6 feet tall and lean. He was younger and clean-cut. His partner was pudgy and a little sloppier. He looked like a guy who bowled in Cleveland on Wednesday nights. The shorter man had to take 2 steps for every one his partner took. His comb-over took a hit as he tried to move quickly. If I was in New York, I would have known exactly where to stop and lay a trap. I'd also have a gun. Here, all I could do was move a little faster. I took a corner. They followed. I took another corner. Same result. I could see the wide automatic doors that led outside almost 100 yards in front of me. I'd never make it without these two catching me, so I made a quick left turn into a hallway that led to bathrooms and some kind of maintenance area. It was the best chance I had to surprise them. I slipped in next to a support column. If they looked down the hallway, they wouldn't see anything. I wasn't sure of my plan beyond that. I quickly scanned the area to see if there was anything I could use as a weapon. It reminded me of a time when I'd been surprised by 2 would-be muggers in Philadelphia, when a 2-foot-long piece of metal rebar I picked up from the ground in front of a construction site slid nicely up the sleeve of my jacket. The 2 muggers, who had been following me for 3 blocks, never even noticed me stop. When they caught up to me in front of the convention center near Chinatown, I was ready for a confrontation. Like all bullies, muggers count on fear and intimidation. So when I realized all they had was a knife between them, I let the rebar slip into my hand. It had taken only 1 swing through the air to frighten both of the men into a sprint toward North Broad Street. But in this hallway, I saw nothing remotely helpful. Now all I could do was ball my hands into fists. Chapter 55. It felt like I was behind the column for hours until I heard the men talking in low tones. I couldn't even tell what language they were speaking. Then one of them started to walk down the hallway toward me. It was the taller of the two men. Good. If I took him out, the second man appeared easier to deal with. The tall one walked right past the post, focused on the men's room door down the hall. Apparently, he was pretty sure that's where I had gone. As soon as he was past me, I rushed him like a defensive end. I could hear him lose his breath as I caught him by surprise and knocked him about 4 feet through the air. He landed on the polished floor and slid another 2 feet into the wall. I had no time to admire my handiwork, though I did have a moment of satisfaction. Anytime you knock down someone bigger and younger than you, it's a point of pride. I was going to kick him in the head to make sure he was out of the fight when the other man appeared almost right next to me. I had my right fist prepared to aim for his chin, or should I say chins. He was sweating, and his black hair fell in every direction, like he just stepped out of the shower. Before I can take any action, he said one of the few things that would freeze me in place. "Detective Michael Bennett, we're FBI. Stand down." Anyone could say that. But a seasoned cop knew when he heard another seasoned cop speak. Plus, we were in Estonia, and this guy was speaking English with a Boston accent. I kept my posture with my fist cocked. The shorter, pudgy man eased around me to check on his friend, who was coming up onto his hands and knees. He helped him up, and they both faced me. The shorter man said, "Put your goddamn fist down. We're adults. We're also Americans in a foreign country. Don't embarrass us." I said, "How'd you know I'd be here?" "Are you kidding me? You think there are no former NYPD detectives with the Bureau? You think they don't know what's going on with your useless intelligence unit? I had to hump it up here from our official office in Riga, Latvia. You know how far that is?" I didn't know what to say, so I shrugged and said, "Pretty far?" The FBI agent mumbled, "Asshole." Then he looked at me and said, "You bet your ass is pretty far. Maybe not by U.S. standards, but driving a shitty road 300 kilometers is no picnic. And I had plenty to do in Riga. I hardly ever come up to Estonia." I thought it best to play along. "So you must have a pretty big area of responsibility, all the Baltics and what else?" "Don't get me started. Three of us do the work of two entire squads. And you know why?" "Know why?" "Because it's our job. We actually have jurisdiction here and work closely with the national police. As far as we're concerned, you're just a tourist who's here to cause problems. Which is why we took the time to haul ass up here and meet you right at the gate." "Well, that was very thoughtful of you. I don't generally get that kind of service from the FBI in New York. Although they often deliver a similar speech about jurisdiction. Do they teach you that at Quantico?" "I'm sorry, I don't even know your name." I smiled and stuck out my hand, knowing that would annoy these FBI agents more than anything. The tubby guy groaned in frustration. Finally, he shook my hand. "My name's Bill Fiore. This kid who can't take a body blow is Matt Miller. We know you're here on a case, but we'd like to know exactly what you're doing 4,000 miles from home. At the moment, I'm knocking around a couple of FBI agents. Tomorrow, I thought I might do some sightseeing." Fiore said, "Do you think we're idiots? Is that a rhetorical question?" "Smart guy, huh? I got news for you, Mr. Big Shot Detective. You're not welcome in Estonia. Your ass is coming with us until we can load you on a plane back to the States." He took a moment to run a hand through his hair and flop it back into place over his spreading bald spot. He was about 40, and on closer inspection, looked like he used to be in reasonable shape. Maybe the food in Europe agreed with him. I gathered my thoughts. "I really don't see what legal authority you have to send back a tourist. I'm not here on official business." "Bullshit. You NYPD guys think you could do anything, go anywhere because of your intel unit. But we have legal authority to be here. You don't. That's why you're getting on a plane tomorrow and heading back to New York before you cause any problems." The younger guy, Miller, grabbed me by the upper arm like I was a suspect being led away in cuffs. I had to admit he had a serious grip. Fiore fell in on the other side of me as they started marching me toward the main exit. Chapter 56. It felt like I was being marched to prison. Had my mission failed so quickly and completely? Maybe someone in the intel unit disagreed with me going to Estonia to look for the mayor's daughter and it tipped off the FBI. Maybe it was someone in the mayor's office itself. Either way, my heart sank. I walked along silently. I didn't see what I could do at the moment. I couldn't even ask to speak to someone at our embassy. It was my own government detaining me. I wasn't about to hurt another U.S. cop, no matter how much he annoyed me. All I could do was walk along. I was trying to resign myself to the situation. A younger man in a Fila jacket walked past and bumped into Bill Fiore. Then he turned around and started shouting at the FBI agent in what I was sure was French, and he sounded pissed off. To my surprise, Fiore answered him in French, and he sounded like every other annoyed Bostonian I had ever heard, except he was speaking French. Their voices echoed a little in this less busy section of the airport. A young woman closing up her newsstand for the evening looked on silently. Fiore faced the man and stepped toward him. The tubby FBI agent had no fear, that was for sure. Then someone else came from the side and bumped into the younger FBI agent Miller. He bumped into him hard enough to knock him off his feet. Apparently, this guy had a hard time staying upright. I wondered if I would have to help my captors in some sort of confrontation. Then a pair of strong hands grabbed me from behind and started leading me toward the front door. A voice from behind me said in English, "Just keep walking, don't do anything stupid." Not doing something stupid was always my goal. I found that I was not always able to accomplish that goal. For the moment, I moved along with my new captors, but I was looking for an angle, something that would help me if I fought or if I ran. I couldn't believe it, but suddenly I was worried about the two FBI agents' safety. I had no idea who these new guys were, but I didn't want them to hurt any cops. Outside, a beat-up red Fiat skidded to a stop right in front of us. I didn't like the looks of this at all. If I got in that thing, there was no telling where I would end up, or more important, who I might end up meeting. I had to do something. I started to turn and look back into the terminal. A strong forearm kept my head from turning and shoved me forward. That was one plan out the window. Where were the uniformed cops in this airport? If something like this happened in JFK, there'd be a dozen cops pouncing on us right now. Here, about to be shoved into a car headed to God knows where. I had to think of something else fast. Chapter 57. As soon as I was shoved into the back seat of the Fiat, I swung my elbow back. I had no idea where I would catch the person behind me, but I was hoping it'd be in the face. My plan got hazy after that. The man behind me blocked my elbow, hard. His forearms felt like steel. Then he surprised me. The man called out, "Whoa, hold on, Ace, I'm on the job." I froze at the combination of a Brooklyn accent and the code for a plainclothes NYPD officer. "I'm on the job" goes back decades. The origin is unclear, but it means I'm a cop. So I listened. The Fiat sputtered away from the curb. The airport building faded from the side view. I glanced out the rear window to see if the FBI agents were following. It looked like we were in the clear, although I had no idea what the FBI would drive in Estonia. In New York, if they weren't in a Crown Vic or a Taurus, they were in some weird seized vehicle like a Land Rover or Cadillac. I sat back in the seat. The man next to me settled down too, giving me space like a zookeeper would with an agitated animal. He said, "That's better." He stuck out his hand. "I'm Barry Davis, NYPD. He grinned as if he just told a joke. I took his hand and assessed him. He was a powerfully built man, about 45, with a crew cut that had gone gray. I realized my hand was on my elbow where I had tried to strike Davis. It still throbbed a little, but I wasn't going to admit it. I controlled my breathing, then pushed my hair back into place. I was stalling as I accepted my new surroundings and companions. I said, "The driver doesn't speak?" Davis smiled. He'd rather not be identified, seeing as how we're way out of our home base doing a favor for Lieutenant Martindale. Well, that's a good partner. The best. And he doesn't want to know why the FBI tried to detain you. You know, plausible deniability and all that shit. We figured they were more worried about their jurisdiction. They hate the NYPD. I asked, where are you assigned? Paris. No shit. And you came all the way up here to help me? NYPD never leaves a detective behind. He handed me a folded newspaper. Or unarmed. I opened the paper to see a black Beretta 9mm inside. I pulled the slide back a few centimeters to check if a round was in the chamber. It was loaded and ready to go. Davis smiled and said, in case of emergency. Then he handed me a card with just a phone number. Any problems you can't handle, call that number. I'll be in Bonn on an unrelated issue. We're off the books. No official engagement at all, but that doesn't mean you're alone. Thanks. Did Martindale tell you what I was up to? Nope, and I don't want to know. Remember, we'll deny everything if you cause a bunch of shit here. I was impressed by Martindale's tight lips. I won't do anything that reflects poorly on us. Davis laughed. Me? I was never here. How could it reflect poorly on me? I smiled. I meant it won't embarrass the NYPD. Still not an issue I'm worried about. Cops have got enough to worry about. All I care about is that you get home safely. Thanks. That's my main concern, too. We pulled up to a 4-story hotel on the edge of the city. Davis said, you're all set up here. Good luck. He handed me my small carry-on bag, which I thought had been lost in the scuffles. Then, they were gone. Chapter 58. Christoph Visser and Ollie Van Netta were happy to be back in Amsterdam. Here, the pot was better, they knew plenty of girls, and Christoph was able to stop by his mother's apartment. His mom was always happy to see her engineer. At least that's what he told her he did for a living, a traveling engineer. His fake diploma from Erasmus University in Rotterdam hung on the wall of her living room, along with photos of his late father. Christoph enjoyed playing the role of dutiful and respectful son. He liked seeing his mother happy and proud. And when he visited home, he did everything his mother expected of him. He even attended Mass at Christmas and Easter. Christoph knew this deception would work because for 25 years, his father had worked as a collector for a loan shark. Christoph's mother had believed her husband's lie, that he was an accountant for a private equity firm. The gullible tend to be the happiest. No matter what he told his mother, Christoph wanted to take care of her. She was the only one in his whole life who cared what happened to him. She was the only one he didn't want to disappoint. When he killed someone when he was young, Christoph realized it didn't bother him. That wasn't to say he enjoyed killing. He didn't. He did it to make money. Money he planned to use on a nice house for his mother and a wild apartment for himself. He had, on occasion, appreciated killing someone, like those asses Janos and Alice. He and Ollie had made good money for that one, but it had been fun, too. It had been satisfying. He found Ollie at his favorite coffee house on the edge of the tourist district in Amsterdam. He usually went to a place in Hamburgstraat called Damkring. Tonight he was in a smaller place down the street that didn't mind when Ollie dozed off in a booth, as long as he spent plenty of money and didn't cause problems. They both had been careful to keep their profession a secret. Since they had met Hendrik Lahr, who liked to be called Henry, their fortunes had seen a serious upturn. They didn't have to seek out work. Henry paid well. And they liked their small, shared apartment in Tallinn, Estonia. In Amsterdam, Christoph maintained his own apartment. He brought home too many women to make sharing an apartment reasonable. It also gave him a sense that he was on vacation whenever he came to his hometown. Ollie lived with his father, who operated a bed and breakfast in the suburb of Haarlem. His father didn't know and didn't care what Ollie did for a living. That worked out great for Ollie. Aside from occasionally taking out the garbage or checking in a guest, Ollie did little to help his father. Kristoff took a moment to shake his partner out of his hash-induced daze. The 38-year-old blinked his eyes a dozen times and sat up straight, as if he'd just heard a fire alarm. He brushed his brown, greasy hair from his eyes and tucked the long strands behind his ears. He looked surprised to see Kristoff.
"Hello, my brother. What brings you to Nirvana?"
Kristoff said.
"You need to straighten up. Henry has a job for us."
"Where?"
"I'll give you a hint. Our Nordica flight leaves in 2 hours.
"Shit. Back to Estonia?"
Kristoff said.
"It shouldn't be too bad. Henry is going to give us a bonus for going to New York to kill Janos and Alice."
"Those assholes had it coming."
He scratched his head and looked at Kristoff and asked,
"Why do you think Alice shot the Asian chick in the back?"
"I guess she was just a bitch. We'll never know. And Henry is pissed."
Ollie said,
"Well, he's been quick to use us lately. He's cutting into our party time. I wonder what Ivan's done now."
Kristoff said,
"He said something about a cop from New York."
Chapter 59. The next morning I was up and moving early. Early by Tallinn, Estonia time. It was the middle of the night in New York, and I got a text telling me to call home no matter the time. I made a quick call to let Mary Catherine know I was safe. Somehow I neglected to tell her about my excitement at the airport, just that I was staying in a lovely city with a beautiful old town district on a hill not far away. Her sleepy voice made me homesick. She said,
"You promised to be careful."
"Sure. But what could go wrong? I'm in a country with a low crime rate looking for a missing girl who hangs out with computer geeks. I think I'll manage." She let out that warm Irish laugh and said,
"I love you."
"I love you too." Then it was back to reality. The breakfast in the main room of the hotel included 3 different kinds of fish. I'm not used to salted smelt for breakfast, but they weren't bad. Then I hit the streets with a vengeance. Not like I might in New York. There I knew every street corner, most hustlers, and a lot of cops. Here it was just me, hoping I didn't do anything to be noticed. I had several addresses I wanted to check out from Tony Martindale's Intelligence Bureau resources. The folder he'd handed me on Henry hadn't provided much information, but this turd looked to be bad news from the description they'd acquired through different informants. Usually a criminal was known to be either tough or smart. This guy appeared to be both, but he had no actual criminal history, no arrests at all. That was the sign of the worst kind of criminal. One who was smart enough to work the system or avoid detection altogether. The brief from Intel said he'd attacked the computer system of all the grocery stores in Germany. He had crippled all of their systems, then demanded 10 million euros to let them operate again. The only thing that had stopped him was a bank screw-up. Somehow the account he had been using in Russia at the time was viewable by the police. That saved the German company a fortune. In addition to several other cyber attacks, Henry was listed as responsible for 3 separate murders, 2 in Estonia and 1 in Russia, I thought, and at least 1 in New York. That didn't count the dead at the coffee house. The more I found out about this Henry, the more I looked forward to finally meeting him. I walked along Puovaimu, on the edge of the old town district. The medieval city walls rose right from the sidewalk, and a plaque advised me that Old Town was a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It explained that the first wall went up around the capital in the year 1265 during the reign of Margaret Sambiria. Thus, it is named Margaret Wall. The streets were filled with tourists, and among them I heard a number of American accents. My cab driver had told me Estonians greatly preferred to hear English to Russian if someone wasn't going to speak Estonian. Cruise ships docked at the main port and shuttled busloads of tourists to old towns to see Tompea Castle, as well as farther east to see the Kadriorg Palace. At the moment, I was dodging those crowds. At least 2 cruise ships were in the port, which I could tell by the different groups. Some had blue bags with the Princess Cruises logo on them, others had Norwegian tags on their shirts. Each group shuffled along like the Peanuts gang, all closed in and cramped, trying to hear their guide. I took in the city as I looked for the first address on my list, which turned out to be a warehouse. I could tell by the windows and how clean the interior was that it had been used recently. That fell in with what I knew about cybercriminals. They tended to move from location to location. I inspected the warehouse, hoping to find some clue as to where the operation had moved. I was surprised to find the front door unlocked. I walked in carefully, taking a few photos with my phone as I went. At the far end of an empty loading bay, a man in some kind of janitor's uniform pushed a wide broom. When he noticed me, he smiled and waved. He said something in Estonian. I held up my hands and said, "I'm sorry, I don't speak Estonian." The man, who looked to be about 50 with short gray hair, perked up and said, "English." I nodded, and he walked over to me. "I like to speak English. Where are you from?"
"New York."
"New York, America?"
"That's the one."
I also gave him a quick thumbs up. The man was small and a little hunched over. He patted me on the arm in a friendly gesture. "I'm Gunnar." I took a chance and said, "Gunnar, do you know where the company that was here moved?" He gave me a confused stare, then smiled.
"Computer company."
I nodded.
"They have new building on Tortumante, near Toit City."
"What's Toit City?"
"Nice cafe. You eat, you like."
I had to smile. That was perfect. I thanked the man and eased away from him as he tried to practice more English on me. I stepped outside into the bright sunshine of the Estonian morning. As my eyes adjusted, a man in a suit approached me. I could tell by the way he was walking that he was looking specifically for me. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up. I felt for the pistol stuck in my waistband. Now I really appreciated the efforts of the NYPD last night at the airport. I had almost refused the offer of the gun. Now I was glad I had it. The man stopped 10 paces in front of me and immediately held up some kind of government ID. The way he did it and the look of the ID left no question that he was in law enforcement. It was almost a universal method of identification. He spoke English with only a slight accent. He said, "Mr. Bennett, I need to speak with you." I was made. Chapter 60. The cop seemed a little casual as he approached me. Maybe he wasn't used to the same threats American cops faced every day, and like many criminals in the United States, I was armed. I didn't want to be searched and have the pistol discovered, but there was no way I was going to hurt a cop either. He knew me by name. That was disconcerting. It was a little surreal to be on the other end of a police stop. The fact that I was in a foreign country only made it more uncomfortable. He was about my age and fit, maybe 6 feet tall. His eyes scanned me from head to toe. Then he said, "Why are you here?" "You mean here on the street?" I hated when someone tried to double-talk me in New York. Now I was on the other side of the conversation, and frankly, it was kind of fun. I saw the frustration on the cop's face. I could tell he was wondering if maybe his English wasn't as good as he thought. Then he said firmly, "What are you doing in Estonia?" Not being a hardened street criminal, I stammered but didn't come up with the smart-ass answer. Finally, I spat out, "Sightseeing." I had to wonder if this guy was legit. Was he on Henry's payroll? I became more apprehensive the longer he just stared at me. Then he pulled a phone from his pocket. I didn't know what to do, so I just stood there. I didn't want to make any threatening moves. I certainly wasn't prepared to run. The cop spoke English on the phone. He said, "Yes, it's definitely Bennett." He listened to someone speak for a moment, then replied, "We'll wait right here." I had a sinking feeling in my stomach. I had never heard anything specifically about Estonian cops being corrupt. Certainly not like I'd heard about Russian police or the police in Mexico. I had to make a decision. Was this something I could risk? Not just for my safety, but for Natalie London's. If Henry was as powerful and rich as I'd heard, he could buy a couple of cops, or at least outfit someone to look like a cop. I needed to do something. I just wasn't sure what. Chapter 61. I looked the cop in the eye. He wasn't concerned or frightened in the least, and he wasn't going to back down. I considered running. Then I thought it through. The idea of hiding from the police while searching for a missing girl seemed foolish. A green Peugeot turned the corner and headed for us. I looked up and down the cobblestone street. There weren't as many tourists now. Where were the crowds when you needed them? The car came up to the curb right next to me. A window rolled down and the driver called out, "Get in the car, detective." That made my cheek twitch. This was getting worse by the moment. Then I leaned down and looked through the open window. Sitting behind the steering wheel was the tubby FBI agent, Bill Fiore. He didn't look particularly happy to see me. After the way the NYPD had snatched me away from him at the airport, I understood his frustration. He said, "What are you waiting for? A better invitation? Trust me, I'm doing you a favor." I glanced over at the cop who'd approached me. He was waiting to see how I responded. I said through the open window, "Forgive me if I don't trust the word of an FBI agent telling me he's doing me a favor. And as a New Yorker, your Boston accent makes it sound even less plausible." "Always with the wisecracks. Shut up and get in the car." He waited for a moment and added, "Now!" I nodded to the Estonian cop and slipped into the front seat of the Peugeot. As we pulled away, Fiore said, "The Estonian cops couldn't care less what U.S. law enforcement is doing in their country, as long as we don't cause problems. And that's the only reason you're here, Detective Bennett, to cause problems."
"And how would you know that, Special Agent Fiore?"
"Because I'm not a dumbass. You think I don't know who helped you escape at the airport? Maybe you're not as stupid as you look."
Fiore chuckled.
"I could say the same about you."
I said, "So we're fighting a turf war 4,000 miles from home?"
"It's not a turf war. You have no jurisdiction, and now your ass is going home."
I said, "You don't even know exactly why I'm here. I'm looking for a missing girl."
"Yeah, I know, I know. Spoiled rich girl whose father could fire you."
"It's not like that. He hasn't threatened me or offered me anything. You don't understand. She's fallen in with a group of cyber criminals. She could be in danger." He pulled the car roughly to the curb and turned to me. His voice ticked up in volume.
"No, you don't understand. She's with that group. She's helping them. They've caused all kinds of shit and made enemies on both sides of the law. Even a goddamn Yakuza thinks they've been disrespected. A Colombian cartel wants them to pay tribute, and don't get me started on the Russians. Who knows what those dickwads will do?
She may be a kidnap victim. I might even have a location, a warehouse over on Tartu Manti, across from a cafe named Toit City."
"Doesn't matter. Too dangerous. We can't have a shootout in Tallinn. It's not the south side of Chicago. I intend to get you to the airport and sit with you until your flight at 2100 local time. You'll be back in New York tomorrow. As I understand it, you're a pretty decent homicide, Dick. Go back to solving murders."
I gave him a sideways glance as an idea popped into my head.
You had to be some kind of real cop before the FBI.
The real cop, Dick, was inadvertent. Every big city detective knows the FBI hates that. It just came naturally. Fiore was used to it. He proudly said,
"Brookline, Mass. How could you tell?"
"The homicide dick comment. Only an old school cop would use a term like that." He nodded his agreement. "I can't believe a cop would let a missing girl go without any investigation. You've been with the Phoebes too long."
"Suck it, Mr. NYPD. I'm just following orders."
"So are the guards at Auschwitz."
"That's a low blow."
I sighed and looked down at my lap. Then I set the trap. "I guess you know all about me."
"More than I care to."
"So you know my grandfather is a Catholic priest?"
"It's about the only thing redeeming I've heard about you."
"He asked me to pick up research documents while I'm here. They can't be mailed or shipped. They're at a Russian Orthodox church named St. Laszlo's. Do you know it?"
"Sure, it's not a main tourist attraction like Alexander Nevsky up on the hill, but I've passed it a million times."
"If I leave the country quietly, will you just let me pick up the envelope first? At least I'll accomplish one thing on this trip." I felt a little guilty pulling the Catholic card, but Fiore relented.
"As long as it only takes a minute." Chapter 62. Christoph and Ollie had wasted no time once their Nordica flight landed early in the morning. Henry had someone meet them at the airport who provided a car and a couple of Czech pistols, but Christoph still had to run by their apartment and pick up his favorite knife. He never knew when he might need it. Ollie had slept only a couple of hours, but he seemed alert and ready to go. Christoph often marveled at his partner's ability to bounce back after a hard night of partying, although he'd seen that hash had less of an effect on Ollie than heroin. They were lucky to catch the American cop just as he walked out of his hotel. They followed the cab and waited for the right moment to strike. Henry had instructed them to capture the detective and bring him back to their current headquarters. As a last resort, they were authorized to shoot him. From the very beginning, Ollie mocked the American cop. He laughed at the way the cop stood in front of the hotel waiting for a cab. He was tall and handsome and looked like a statue. Ollie stuck his hand in his shirt like Napoleon and posed. He said, "Vi's an American detective here. Maybe he can scare criminals into surrendering in New York, but does he realize he has no pull here?" Christoph laughed. He didn't know why the American detective was here or what his interest in Henry was. All he knew was that his boss wanted the cop brought to him and that Henry paid well. For someone who made his living beating and killing people, it was a pretty simple task. They were both shocked to see the cop go directly to the warehouse where Henry used to have an operation. This guy was well-connected and informed. Ollie said, "Let's grab him as soon as he comes out of the warehouse. We can slip him into the back seat without anyone noticing."
"What if he gives us a fight?"
"Henry said we could shoot him. You stand by with your pistol in case he gives me any shit."
Christoph shrugged. His partner's plan was simple and direct. He liked it. The hitch came when they noticed an Estonian policeman they recognized approach the entrance to the warehouse. Ollie said,
"What's that uptight prick doing here?"
"Probably the same thing as us."
"Too bad Henry couldn't get him on the payroll," Christoph said.
"You think Henry would appreciate it if we blasted both of them right now?"
The decision was moot when a green Peugeot pulled up and the detective got inside. Ollie said,
"What should we do? Probably stay with him for a while, huh?"
Christoph had to agree. Chapter 63. I called my grandfather. Fiore made me put the phone on speaker so he could hear everything we said. It was a pretty smart move. Too bad I had confidence that my grandfather was craftier than any FBI agent ever born. He answered his personal residence phone immediately. He had a slight scratch in his throat, and I knew I had woken him from a sound sleep. I said, "Hey, Grandpa, it's Michael calling from Estonia." Me calling him Grandpa would have immediately alerted him that something was up. I could tell by the pause he was trying to figure it out. He said,
"What time is it there, Michael? Because it's god-awful early here. Everything all right?"
"Sorry, I forgot you're 7 hours behind us in New York."
"How's the trip so far?"
I could tell he was stalling as he figured out what was going on. He had to hear that we were on speakerphone. I wasn't going to make the obvious move and tell him. That might tip off the FBI agent that we were planning something.
"Everything's good. I'm coming home early."
"Oh, why is that?" "The FBI is forcing me to go home. In fact, an agent is driving me to the airport right now."
"Can you call your friend at St. Laszlo's and tell him I'll pick up that reference material you needed?"
Seamus played it perfectly. All he said was,
"Oh, you bet, boyo."
I thanked him and hung up. I looked over at Bill Fiore and said, "Satisfied?" He nodded. "I won't tell an elderly priest that a good Catholic boy from Brookline, Massachusetts didn't trust him and that you maybe talk to him on speaker." Fiore visibly softened for a moment.
"I know you're not a bad guy. My guess is you're over here for all the right reasons, but the FBI has to maintain a relationship with all the countries that allow us to operate within their borders. I can't have every hotshot cop in the U.S. coming over here thinking they could do whatever they want.
How many cops want to come to Estonia?"
"You have no idea how much cybercrime originates from here. Teenagers with access to high-speed internet are figuring out schemes to bilk old people out of money in the U.S. Every swinging dick in this country has a computer. Sounds like it's a good idea for me to leave. Finally, you're making some sense.
Chapter 64. Thank God St. Laszlo's was on the way to the hotel, where I still needed to pick up my carry-on bag. It was hard enough to convince the FBI agent to bring me to the church, let alone to let me get my bag before we headed to the airport. The church was certainly not as grand as the Alexander Nevsky Cathedral on the hill in Old Town. It looked more like a suburban church in Baltimore, but it was still clearly Orthodox, with the three horizontal bars on the cross, the bottom bar at an angle, and much smaller than the middle bar. There were no tourists here. Only a few cars were in the parking lot alongside the church, probably the staff vehicles and something for the priest to drive. We parked on the street directly in front, where a walkway lined with budding bushes led to the main entrance. I opened the door and Fiore opened the driver's door. He just looked at me and said, "You think I'm gonna let you just walk away? I'm with you until I see your smiling face walk down the jetway to your plane." This could get tricky. I considered how far I'd be willing to go to escape the FBI's custody. A priest in his clerical cassock stepped out the front door and waved to me. He was nothing like I had expected. I don't know why I had assumed a friend of my grandfather's would also be an elderly man, but this priest was in his early 50s with slightly graying hair. He looked to be in pretty good shape and had clear blue eyes. He hurried down the steps and along the walkway, extending his hand.
"You have got to be Seamus's grandson, Michael. I would see the resemblance anywhere."
I wasn't sure if that was a compliment, but I shook his hand and thanked him. I said, "This is my..." I paused for a moment, then finished.